Hello and welcome to a special bonus episode of the Shock Doctors podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Jarendaisy.
And we're going to be discussing some of our favorite horror films of 2018 as we're reaching the end of the year. We're having a little bit of a retrospective.
Feeling a little sentimental.
Just a bit. Now, obviously, some of our favorite horror movies of the year we've already discussed in full episodes of the podcast.
Episode and a half in some cases.
Yeah, right. Well, our consensus favorite horror film of the year, Suspiria.
Yep.
Not only did we have a probably longer than average initial episode about it, we also had our very first bonus episode.
Mm-hmm. Got to get all the meat off those bones.
Yeah, dedicated to expanding upon it further. So, we're not going to talk about Suspiria in this episode, but mm-hmm. I just did want to say that that is our favorite horror film of the year.
Yeah, and the fact that it was so critically divisive only makes me want to sing its praises all the more, because it's always fun to have a hot take and come in on one side or the other of a big critical divide like that.
Yeah. So it is taking a great deal of restraint for us not to talk about it at length again.
Yes.
So best to move on at this point.
But unfortunately, yes.
So what's one we haven't talked about, Matt, that you really enjoyed from the past year?
I think the standout horror release, certainly in terms of its cultural footprint that predates the podcast, is Hereditary.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember when it came out exactly, but it was on June. It was on everybody's lips for like months, and I liked it a whole lot. It's not perfect by any means, and anytime a movie is trumpeted as like, you know,
the next Exorcist.
Exactly. It's whatever. Always the Exorcist. Yeah.
Well, it's got to be.
Yeah, right.
Pretty much.
That you know, I don't care for, but critics are going to say what they're going to say. And once they say it, it's going on the poster. You know,
yeah.
No marketing team in their right mind would leave that quote off the poster. I don't think it's that caliber per se, but it really did unnerve me in a big way. And the tragic centerpiece moment in it that sends aftershocks out through the whole movie on either side of it. Spoiler alert.
This bonus episode is going to be riddled with spoilers,
yes.
So just bear that in mind.
Yeah.
If you hear the name of a movie that you want to see and have not, you should
head for the hills.
Stop listening.
Yeah. The death of the young girl was genuinely upsetting.
Fucking brutal.
Yeah, and that really elevated the whole thing for me. It just undergirds all the horror to follow, gives it a real emotional resonance, a real heft that was missing from most other horror movies released this year.
Yeah. I also liked Hereditary, you know, obviously for all of its merits on the face of it, but also because it gave Gabriel Byrne the first really sort of hefty,
meaty role
that I've seen him have in years.
Yeah, he was really good. He was kind of the rock in that movie, not like Dwayne Johnson, but like
right.
He was the most stable character, which both does him a service and a disservice, I think. You know, after a certain point, it becomes a handicap because
yeah.
He can't confront the true nature of what's transpiring. He's the, you know, the resident skeptic, I guess, which is kind of a thankless role in a lot of movies, a lot of horror movies, supernatural movies, but he makes the most of it.
Absolutely.
And Toni Collette is just outstanding, you know?
Yeah.
She was getting a lot of Oscar buzz, at least back in the summer. I don't know, you know, the Academy has a pretty short memory. So,
it has a short memory, and also it doesn't like genre films.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's one of those things that you're going to see a lot of buzz in blogs and stuff like, oh, IndieWire thinks that Toni Collette's going to get nominated for an Oscar, and then, mm-hmm. you know.
And then she makes IndieWire's list of Oscar snubs.
Exactly.
Surprising no one.
Yeah. It's like, justified though it might be, it's not fucking happening.
Yeah, well, who knows? I mean, Get Out did pretty well. So
that's true.
Yeah.
Who
can say? Yeah. I don't know. I can't fathom the mind of the Academy. That's the real Lovecraftian entity in all of this. The real unknowable evil. Toni Collette's great. Gabriel Byrne is great. Whole cast acquits themselves really well and turned a lot of people off. And it's not perfect, but the ending just checks so many boxes for me. I love pagan cults so fucking much. And Ari Aster, I think that's how his name is pronounced, or Aster, or Aster, the director's new film, I think it's called Midsommar. It's spelled all funky, but it's Midsommar, basically. And it sounds like the most Wicker Man thing ever. I'm so here for it.
Oh, yeah, I'm on board.
Just, I don't know. There's just, like, a lot of really good filmmaking in there. There's a lot of figures that you can just barely discern in the darkness, where they obviously tinkered with the lighting level to get it down to an exact science. Like, there's a one shot in particular that elicited gasps, audible gasps from the audience. I saw it twice, and both times you could hear people reacting at different moments. It's when Toni Collette is perched on the ceiling like a fucking tarantula. And it's just a great shot because it lingers. It's a wide shot of a bedroom. It lingers for a long time. And, you know, your eye tracks up and down the image, like, where's Waldo, looking for possible threats.
And then there's Waldo, yeah. And you just about lose your shit.
There's a great shot in Carrie, the one with Sissy Spacek, yeah. The original, where her mother, played by Piper Laurie, is kind of lurking in the background. That similarly trusts the audience to be vigilant and to pick her out from the white noise and react accordingly without the movie necessarily having to draw attention to her. That felt like, if not an homage, then they both had the same idea. Executed it very well.
It's something that I really respect about the best J-horror and K-horror films.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Japanese and Korean, for those of you,
for you layman
up on the lingo. And it's a slightly different thing, and I'll expound on it briefly, but the horror that they extract, it's not, I mean, there are jump scares, sure. I mean, every horror movie has to have jump scares to a certain extent. It's how it works. But the best scares are the ones where you see something horrifying and you're, you know, forced to deal with it,
mm-hmm.
and just stare at it for a while.
Yeah, it's not content to just spook you and move on. It's scary even after you've gotten really up close and personal with it, which is something you cannot say about, you know, The Nun, for example. We griped about that in our review, but sure. that's kind of a more of a Western phenomenon where a monster is only the sum of its jump scares.
Right.
But in the best horror movies, yeah, that's not the case. It's scary when it startles you, and it's scary.
It continues to be scary.
Yeah, it remains scary even after you've come to terms with it, or yeah. failed to come to terms with it.
The example I always like to point to, there's a scene in the Ji-Woon Kim film, A Tale of Two Sisters. Mm-hmm. So, again, spoilers if you haven't seen it. Also, go see it.
Yes, please.
Watch it, please, for the love of God. There's a scene where one of the sisters is alone in her bedroom, and there's like a ghost in the opposite corner of the room, and the movie just makes you look at the ghost like creep very, very slowly closer for like a solid minute.
Mm-hmm.
There's really no like cross cutting
yeah.
or anything. It shoves your face in it and makes you look, and it's yeah. It's tough to watch.
There's an outstanding shot like that in Pulse, the Kiyoshi Kurosawa film, too. The first ghost in that movie is one of the eeriest fucking things I've ever seen. It just does not cut away. It like just traverses the entire frame. Starts in the background and moves inexorably into the foreground.
In very inhuman fashion. Yeah. We sort of flippantly refer to it as noodle ghost, yeah. but that is not meant as an indication of not being terrified.
No, that's us trying to diffuse it.
it's trying to make ourselves feel better.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're getting a little bit off track.
Yeah, we're getting into the weeds a little bit. Hereditary, it has its flaws, but it warrants being mentioned in the company of those other movies, which is, you know, high praise indeed.
Yes.
The ending did throw a lot of people for a loop. It is a little bit inscrutable, but I'm just such a sucker for satanic cults and sinister pagan plots that I just kind of rolled over like a dog getting its belly rubbed. I couldn't have been happier.
Yeah. So the next movie I wanted to touch on is A Quiet Place.
Yeah.
Which...
Regardless of the other standout horror movie from this year, especially in terms of box office, it did very, very well.
Yeah. It's definitely a knock it out of the park writing directing debut for mm-hmm. John Krasinski. Like, holy shit. The one thing about this movie that makes me sort of hesitate to bring it up is that I go back and forth on whether or not I consider it, like, actually a horror movie. Because, don't get me wrong, like, yeah, okay, monsters that can hear you talk from miles away and come and hunt you down and rip you apart, that's a horrifying concept. But as clenched as my butthole was for the duration of that film, it was more a tension and less of a fright. And I go back and forth on this. I can't decide whether I'm just splitting hairs, but there is a part of me that is fairly well convinced that A Quiet Place is a thriller, a very good one, but not really a horror movie. So I don't know exactly how to classify it.
I generally try not to split hairs, but I do understand and relate to the phenomenon that you're describing. I feel like the premise of A Quiet Place is such a recipe for jump scares, with the disparity between dead silence and then something loud and scary and frenetic. You know, that it's like a lot of horror movies operate in that mode, where right before a loud scare chord happens, things will get really quiet for, like, maximum impact. And in shitty horror movies, that's just one way for the movie to play its hand too soon. When things get really quiet, you know that you're about to get spooked. It's just telegraphing the scare. There might as well be an on-screen countdown half the time. 3, 2, 1, like you're waiting at the crosswalk. No, A Quiet Place was a very tense experience. I was slightly lukewarm on it just for the reasons you were describing. I wasn't as scared as I wanted to be. I'm really into, like, creature design, like monster design, and the monsters in that movie. I just wish they'd had a couple more legs or something to make them a little bit, you know, they were, I liked their big, gross, exposed external eardrums.
Yeah.
That was suitably grotesque, but their faces just kind of looked like symbiote suits, like
a turd in the wind,
like that kind of symbiote. But I just feel like if you'd just given them 3 or 4 more legs, that would have been like a 10 out of 10, like, pants shitting experience for me. Cause I've got a thing about spiders,
yes.
You know? So, like, I guess I get that not everyone can relate to that specific phobia, but I think it's prevalent enough that if you'd just given it, like, some kind of beady insectoid eyes, maybe some mandibles, you know, made it slightly, just leaned into what people are already afraid of more, rather than coming up with a new creature that isn't actually that novel.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of looks like things that I've already seen. So that I didn't love. And then the other thing, the movie kind of fails to deliver on a promise that it sets up at the beginning, which is that the prologue is so hardcore. The way it takes out the one kid, with just
fucking
absolutely
brutal.
Pitiless, and I was like, "Holy shit, we're in for a wild ride!" Like, these kids are not safe. But then, it only took me like maybe half an hour to 40 minutes to sort of my defenses came back up, basically, because it became apparent once you'd spent a significant amount of time with the surviving 2 children. That basically no harm was going to come to them. I kind of started to get, and I don't know exactly what to attribute this to. I think it's, the movie has kind of traditional values. You know, it's about a family unit that comes together through adversity, rather than in Hereditary, where you have a family getting torn apart and saying really vicious things, wounding things to each other. Yeah, wounds that cannot be healed. Which is more my kind of horror movie, because I'm a misanthrope. But then in Quiet Place, you know, you have, like, the father heroically sacrificing himself and all that.
Although that is a pretty fucking epic sacrificial moment as they go.
Yeah. Where was I going with this? Oh, I started getting sort of M. Night Shyamalan-y vibes from it a little bit. And, like, good Shyamalan. Like top
Not
shelf.
The happening.
Top shelf Shyamalan. It reminded me the most of Signs, I think, is what I would compare it to,
which makes a certain amount of sense, because, you know, it's about a family that's hiding from aliens
surrounded by corn.
So yeah. Yes,
but it goes, like, a little bit deeper than that, because, you know, that movie has a kind of contrived arc for Mel Gibson where he's a priest who rediscovers his faith.
Yeah,
I got a little bit of a whiff of that around the characters in A Quiet Place, where there kind of wasn't that much uncertainty about whether they were going to make it through, if they were going to die, you know, like John Krasinski, they were going to die on their own terms. So yeah, I wasn't blown away by A Quiet Place, but this was a good year, a really good year for horror movies. So it had some steep competition.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely true. Another movie I liked quite a bit was a Netflix release called The Apostle, I think it was. Not just Apostle. I don't know. I go back and forth. It's one or the other.
Yeah. It shouldn't be too hard to find in any case.
Right. Type in Apostle on Netflix. It'll come up. It'll probably be the first result. Unless that...
Along with a shitload of other stuff that has nothing to do with it because their algorithms are fucked.
Yeah. Anyway, so Apostle follows Dan Stevens, who you may recognize from, I think, Downton Abbey. I've never watched it, but I think that was his big breakthrough thing. And then after that, he did The Guest, which I like a lot. And he's also the lead on FX's Legion. Anyway, Dan Stevens, he's good. He plays this son of, like, a wealthy family who's basically gone missing. It's, like, early 20th century, like, very early, the aughts.
Mm-hmm.
Who's been missing for, I don't know, 5 or 10 years or something. I think he may have been a missionary or something who didn't come home for a very long time. And his father has died. And presumably his mother died a very long time ago. And his sister has gone missing. She, like, joined up basically with this cult. And they went off to this island. And that's where they live. And, you know, worship in their way.
Mm-hmm.
And
but what do they worship? That's the question.
Right, you know, exactly.
It always is.
And basically, he is tasked by his father's estate, basically. He emerges from the woodwork and is tasked with going undercover in this cult to go find her and bring her home. And his sister was really the only member of his family who ever cared about anyway, so he's obviously on board. And the movie pretty much goes from there. He's sort of rough around the edges, and he's very wary, justifiably so, of everybody else in the camp. Kind of the leader of the cult is Michael Sheen, who's great.
Mm-hmm.
Although there is some sort of power struggle, which eventually comes to a head with another one of the leaders. And basically what it comes down to is they've been sacrificing animals and people to the sort of creature that is the spirit of the island, mm-hmm. basically.
Some kind of tree god.
Yeah.
Goddess. Some kind of sinister earth mother.
Yeah. And if they keep the earth mother well fed, then their crops are very bountiful and so forth, and they prosper. And when they start running out of shit to feed her, things start going bad, and that's about what happens.
Mm-hmm.
It's very much a slow burn of a movie. It's over 2 hours, which for a horror movie, obviously, we know is pretty long. But
I didn't really feel the length with that one.
No, I didn't.
There was enough to keep me occupied.
It clipped along.
A lot of intrigue, especially in the early stretch.
And again, a lot of pretty good actors having meaty dialogues.
Yeah, and speaking of meat, there's a lot of meat work in the finale that's pretty engrossing and also just, you know, gross.
Yes. Yeah. One kid basically gets his brains drilled out with like an auger.
I don't remember that specifically. I remember a whole bunch of other maimings and a lot of splatter.
Yeah, no, the kid from The Lodgers, that like Irish
movie. Oh, yes.
Yeah, he's the one who like knocked up somebody's daughter in The Apostle and then has to get his brains drilled out.
Yes.
But anyway, yeah, that's brutal. And the movie in general is quite good. As I said, it's a Netflix original, so if you have Netflix, it will always be available anytime you want. Go have a look.
Yes. The Netflix release that I want to zero in on and give a shout-out for is Cam, which is not unlike A Quiet Place. Well, it's unlike A Quiet Place in pretty much every respect.
Yes.
But what they have in common is that it's kind of a fringe, like it's a borderline case where, you know, is it a horror movie? Is it a thriller? So it's about a cam girl who struts her stuff on a webcam and racks up views and interacts with her audience in a chat room.
And gets tokens.
Yeah, and is, yeah, exactly, some kind of currency. She hosts all her content on this one site. It's basically her whole platform, her whole online identity.
Yeah.
And that identity is taken from her. It looks like her account has been hacked, and then that's the catalyst, and then gradually that hacking takes on more and more ominous implications. And for what sounds like a laughably low-stakes premise, because we made fun of, like, Friend Request for, you know, being kind of reefer madness-y about the internet, and there's a little bit of that in Cam, but for the most part, I found it really stressful, like surprisingly so.
Yeah.
Because this is her livelihood, and because her work is stigmatized and she herself is marginalized, you know, it's very difficult for her to get any traction whatsoever or make any headway on trying to resolve the problem. You know, it's just over and over again. So customer support is a dick to her, and then at one point she has to contact the police, and they're a dick to her. Her family doesn't get it, you know, once she gets exposed. There's, like, over and over again. Or like, and her fans are all creeps.
Yeah, too. No, that's
so,
that's
so she's just in such a hostile environment that every scene is just suffused with this tension that, like, I didn't get from... that I don't get from a lot of horror movies, even ones that are much more overtly horrifying.
Yeah. It's really the fact that this movie immerses you in the, like... cam girl underworld,
yeah,
I guess, for
lack
of a
really
better...
ugly rat race.
Yeah,
basically.
And it's just, you really get a sense of just how creepy clients can be.
Mm.
And that's the thing that really got under my skin. Like, there's one guy who's ostensibly the nice guy, and you get creepy vibes from him relatively early, but most of the movie you wonder, is he just kind of creepy, or is he really a scumbag like most of these guys are, that mm-hmm. like you would expect?
Did he have a role in her account being stolen, and is he a murderer? You know, there's a lot of stuff to do with, like, stuff happening around the periphery of the story with other cam girls going missing or being replaced with doppelgangers. You know, a lot of spooky stuff like that that you only get glimpses of. A lot of the storytelling is fairly ambiguous.
Yeah, and in the end, you get pretty clear confirmation on this guy. He's not a murderer, but she does walk in on him in the bathroom jerking off to her doppelganger, mm-hmm. which is just about the most repulsive thing I've seen on screen in a long time.
Yeah, well, because it just shows, you know, that most guys would rather have the copy than the original, you know, especially in that medium. It's a pretty superficial transactional relationship. It really drives home how superfluous her humanity is
yeah.
to most of the people who are connoisseurs of her work, who are supposed to be her biggest fans, and yet who are perfectly satisfied to get a weird Stepford Wife version of her instead of the genuine article. So that's, I think, the root of the horror in that movie. I didn't love the denouement, like the final confrontation with the evil entity. I thought was, I don't know, it left me scratching my head a little bit.
Yeah, I didn't, it was, I will say, it's hog wild. It's nuts.
Yeah.
And
no, it's a good final battle of wills and
yeah.
wits.
And on that level, I enjoyed it. But yes, it's definitely, you don't, and I'm not saying, you know, a movie needs to have all of its questions answered at the end. Obviously, mm-hmm. there are plenty of good, even great movies that don't do that.
Yeah.
But it just, I really had no idea what the deal was. There's just, what is there, just like this weird glitch that generates doppelgangers?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it supernatural? Like, what's the deal?
Right.
Is it some kind of software that is, like, putting a mask over another person?
I was going to say, yeah, because in an era of, what do they call them, deep fakes? That's, like, that's not unheard of. That's, like, you know, like, putting actresses' faces onto the bodies of porn stars. And I'm not talking, like, Photoshop. I'm talking, like, full motion video
mm-hmm.
that's been generating a lot of headlines this year, how that could be used for fake news purposes. You know, there are sample videos floating around of, like, Barack Obama or Vladimir Putin, very convincing looking videos of them saying things that they never actually said, you know? So if that's the angle, then I think that's really good, but I did get demonic vibes from it.
Yeah.
Which
is fine, but yeah. like kind of underwhelming.
Yeah.
We nearly did Cam for an episode of the podcast, but we did end up deciding
it's not quite enough on brand, I think.
Yeah, it's not quite enough horror, but we still, you know, it is horrifying, and we wanted to talk about
it. You know, I liked it a lot. Its politics are in the right place, for, you know, for me at least, and it made me nervous. So,
yes.
Kudos. One more movie I want to draw attention to is kind of a stealth sequel, spiritual successor to a movie from a few years ago called Resolution. It's by Benson and Moorhead. Are those their names?
Yeah.
It's a writer-director duo who first came to my attention because they did a segment in VHS Viral, which is one of the worst movies I've ever seen. But
I think it's my least favorite movie of all time.
Yeah, it's utterly... it's words fail me, obviously.
Truly fucking dreadful.
Yeah. Oh, God, I'm dying. The mere mention of a... Yeah, VHS Viral fucking sucks. But they've gone on to distinguish themselves. They've made a string of kind of indie horror movies that are a good time. And The Endless, which is the one that just came out this past year, is their most ambitious film, I'd say. Maybe, I don't know if it's their best necessarily. I'm charitably disposed towards pretty much all of their post-VHS Viral work. I don't know that I prefer any one of them per se, but it's kind of easy to lump them all together, particularly in the case of Resolution and The Endless, because they share characters in common, which is a pleasant kind of third act surprise.
Mm-hmm.
I like Jim was joking before we started recording when we were talking about what movies we wanted to cover, that back in those of you who have been with us from the beginning, heard our Slenderman episode, know that we took a deep dive into YouTube Slender vlogs.
Yeah.
Like ARG bullshit. And one of the meager pleasures of those shows afforded was the occasional crossover episode.
Yeah. It really, the appearance of the two... Because there's really only two characters in Resolution.
Yeah, it's pretty much a two-hander.
Yeah, the appearance of those two characters as part of this sort of like cross-dimensional clusterfuck in the third act of The Endless scratched exactly the same itch for me as those crossover episodes. I'm going to go way the fuck out on a limb here and assume that perhaps one of you
we
out
got
there...
any Dark Harvest fans in the crowd tonight?
No, fuck Dark Harvest. Tribe 12 and Everyman Hybrid are like the second and third biggest Slenderman ARGs or, you know, web series, whatever. And there's a character in the latter named Jeff who dies and then years later appears in an episode of Tribe 12.
As some kind of specter.
And I lost my fucking shit.
Yeah,
like,
no.
Is that Jeff?
Yeah, eat shit, Marvel Cinematic Universe. Most ambitious crossover event in history.
Yeah,
no.
Fuck you.
Episode, I don't know, 70 whatever. This shitty
Tribe
Slenderman 12. YouTube series. Yeah.
The third best Slenderman series on YouTube.
Right.
But anyway, so... That bit of The Endless scratched exactly that same itch. Mm-hmm. And just like I really enjoy, like Matt was saying, you know, stealth sequels, sort of mashups of things you do not expect.
Yeah.
You know, in media.
Yeah. So The Endless, very briefly, is about two guys. Are they brothers or are they best friends? I don't actually. Two
They're,
dudes.
It's the filmmakers basically playing versions of themselves.
Yeah, that's right.
And they go by their own names, you know, Aaron and Justin.
Justin, that's right. I couldn't remember.
Yeah, Justin Benson, Aaron Moorhead, I believe. And
they're kind of drawn back into the orbit of a cult. It's like a backwoods commune.
Yeah,
that
where they grew up.
That they escaped from, several years back. And they're going back for closure. One of them thinks it's a real bad idea. The other one feels like they need to say goodbye.
Yeah,
basically.
They got this like video, which was addressed to them, and it's from the commune talking about like, we're about to, you know, ascend or whatever the fuck. And then they get there and everybody's still there, which they definitely did not expect.
Right. Cause they get kind of Jonestown vibes from the video. Like they're going to find a bunch of bodies after some kind of mass suicide of kind of event. But yeah, everyone's none the worse for the wear.
And as it turns out, it's because there's this sort of weird
time distortion thing happening in the woods where the cult is located.
Right. So basically, as of the time that Aaron and Justin were living in when they received the video, everybody was probably dead.
Mm-hmm.
But they, again, went through this weird-ass time tunnel.
Yeah, there's some kind of Groundhog Day shenanigans happening in these woods that are never fully explicated. It's hinted at the end of Resolution, which is what made the ending of Resolution so puzzling. But yeah, so having a movie come along that retroactively explains what the fuck was going on in Resolution is right on schedule, basically. I was pleased by that, and I did not go in expecting it.
Yeah.
So hopefully we haven't, you know, ruined that curveball for you. But
well, again, as we've said, if there's a movie you haven't seen that you might like to see, if you hear the name, stop listening.
Yes.
That's the takeaway.
Turn us off mid-sentence. We won't be offended.
But anyway, so yeah, we enjoyed that. And then the last movie I think we're going to talk about just briefly is a Canadian production called Summer of 84, which, as you might expect, is part of the veritable wave of 80s nostalgia that's kind of been unleashed by Stranger Things, among other media and items. Basically, the premise is that this kid is convinced that his next door neighbor, who also happens to be a cop, is a serial killer.
Yep.
Because people have been going missing around his town, not quite to the extent of, say, a dairy, but you know, definitely sketchy. And for the most part, it's like a relatively low stakes, just sort of coming of age, kids doing a stakeout sort of movie, and then it goes
talking on walkie-talkies and shit like that.
And then it goes real dark because it turns out, yep, dude's a serial killer. They like find a decomposing body in his basement and stuff, like
torture
in a tub.
Dungeon, yeah.
And yeah, I got more than I expected out of the movie, I think is the simplest way to put it.
Yeah, the ending is a real fucking bummer in a way that is genuinely haunting, and which I don't feel like the movie fully prepares you for. I think it wants to, you know, catch you off guard, but I don't know. I was of two minds about the finale, but I did admire its cojones, if nothing else. And, you know, fundamentally, Summer of 84 is a movie about a child killer.
Yeah.
So I guess I can't fault them for that.
No. I'm not really familiar with any of the kid actors. I don't think they've really done much of anything else. The serial killer is, I cannot think of the actor's name for the life of me, but he's one of the supporting cast in Mad Men.
Yeah, he's the one who starts the television department.
Yeah, Harry.
Which he basically runs himself.
By himself. Yeah, and he has no subordinates.
He's very good in that role. In Summer of 84, I mean, and also on Mad Men.
Yeah. So, it's kind of our catch-all for the best movies, best horror movies of 2018, obviously.
Yeah, we're just trying to cover our bases. I'm sure that there are some that have slipped through my fingers. I might, you know, we might throw them into the description or something. Right. And we've covered a lot of them. You know, I liked Halloween quite a bit. Fucking loved Suspiria.
Overlord's a lot of fun.
Overlord was good. Yeah. So, yeah, it was a good year, all told.
Well, this has been a surprisingly long bonus episode of the Shock Doctors podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I am Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. We'll see you in 2019.